Israeli forces raid the Aqabat Jabr refugee camp as part of an intensified crackdown against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Iran says its comprehensive cooperation agreement with Venezuela is a turning point in their relations. Also ahead, tensions flare up between the U.S. and China over balloons. Washington claims Beijing had sent into American airspace for spying. Welcome. Our top story this hour: Israeli forces have injured at least 9 Palestinians during a raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jericho. Israeli troops stormed the Aqabat Jabr refugee camp for the 6th consecutive day. They entered the camp with heavy machinery to arrest a Palestinian man they claim had opened fire on an Israeli restaurant. The latest raid comes a day after the regime's forces attacked the city of Nablus and killed one Palestinian there. Elsewhere on Friday, they injured dozens of people who were protesting against the expansion of Israeli settlements on the occupied territories. The regime has intensified its deadly crackdown against Palestinians in recent weeks. 36 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank alone this year so far. Professor of Political Science Mohaimer Abu Saada told us about how Palestinians have been responding to Israel's brutal force across the occupied territories.
The result of that Israeli aggression against the Palestinian civilian people in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem have resulted in the eruption and the beginning of a new Palestinian militant groups, especially in the area of Jenin and Nablus, where we, for the first time in 2022, have seen the rise of Palestinian armed resistance against Israel. We see a new group in the Jenin area, which is called Jenin Brigade, which is a group of Palestinian youth, mainly from Islamic Jihad and other Palestinian youth who are not affiliated with any Palestinian faction. The same thing can be said about the city of Nablus, where we have a new group called the Lion's Den in the old city of Nablus, who are mainly Palestinian youth dedicated to fight back, to resist the Israeli occupation.
Tehran says a comprehensive cooperation agreement between Iran and Venezuela is a turning point in relations between the two countries. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, who is visiting Caracas, made the remarks during a meeting with Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Amir Abdullahian said the implementation of bilateral deals with Caracas would boost ties further. Maduro, for his part, said the experience of the two countries in dealing with shared necessities, is strengthening relations. The two sides also stressed the need to stand up against foreign pressure and defend their national interests. Amir Abdullahian earlier held talks with Venezuela's vice president, among other top officials, and discuss ways to strengthen ties in different fields. Masoud Shajara is a political commentator joining us from the British capital, London. Masoud, what's your take? It's good to see you. What's your take on this latest tour by the Iranian foreign minister, which is in line with the government of Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi to expand ties with regional countries and beyond, but especially in particular those who are also subject to the illegal U.S. measures, U.S. unilateral measures against those countries, such as sanctions?
Yes, I think it's about time. I mean, the reality is that we could even sort of question and wonder why it's taken so long for countries like Venezuela and Iran, who are both target of arrogance of U.S. Hegemony, and sort of illegal, unlawful sanctions and pressures, why is it that they haven't really gone further in past? But it really is a breath of fresh air. The reality is that there is an illusion that has been created in the world that who is the international community? I mean, if you ask who is the international community, usually what they try to elude us all is a small handful of countries, including United States, Canada, Australia, Europe, all white European so-called elite, that they think that they represent the international community. And when you look at some of the voting in the General Assembly of United Nations, like the recent one on Palestine, you see that really these countries, which always have been standing on the side of oppression and on injustice, they are really only 12 to 15% of the international community. And the rest of the world is really standing up against these bullies. This has to be manifested much better. And indeed, those countries need to come together to stop this illusion that the international community or this handful of Western nation under the hegemony of United States. I think this sort of relationship strengthens that, but it needs to go much further.
Okay, Masood, thank you very much indeed for that. Masood Shajara, political commentator, joining us live from the British capital, London. Now, China has accused the U.S. media and politicians of using the recent balloon incident as pretext to launch a smear campaign against Beijing. The Chinese Foreign Ministry issued a statement after the U.S. Secretary of State cancelled a planned trip to the country over allegations that Beijing flew a spy balloon over the U.S. China had already expressed regret over the issue, blaming winds for pushing what it called a civilian airship into U.S. airspace. On Saturday, China further said that it never violated the territory and airspace of any sovereign nation. The ministry also emphasized the need for maintaining communication channels at all levels to deal with some unexpected situations. Antony Blinken issued a personal note to his Chinese counterpart after the discovery of the balloon over the U.S. state of Montana.
In my call today with Director Wang Yi, I made clear that the presence of this surveillance balloon in U.S. airspace is a clear violation of U.S. sovereignty and international law, that it's an irresponsible act, and that the PRC's decision to take this action on the eve of my planned visit is detrimental to the substantive discussions that we were prepared to have.
Blinken further said that the U.S. remains committed to diplomatic engagements with China and that he would make a trip to Beijing once conditions are favorable. Meanwhile, the Pentagon has said it had spotted a second similar balloon flying over Latin America. Beijing had already denied the U.S. accusation of spying. It said the balloon was used for meteorological purposes and had unintentionally escaped into U.S. airspace. Emmanuel Pastrage is the president of Asia Institute. He says the United States is spending a large budget on creating unnecessary hostility with China.
Essentially, we have a system which is out of control. And now, sadly, this relatively tiny group of people within the military and the arms contractors are making policy for the entire country, feeding it to the politicians, and they have really no brakes on them. They're going, in the case of Ukraine, basically any weapon, except for nuclear weapons so far, although that might come soon, is being fed. In the case of China, a country, I think as a whole, Chinese have a relatively positive view of the United States. Many Chinese have family in the United States. It was not a hostile relationship, but billions and billions of dollars are being poured into making it, hyping it up to be some sort of enemy. And Blinken's trip is totally logical. He should go very frequently, canceling it over this one minor matter out of you know, thousands of similar ones, really shows us that the whole system is falling apart. The wheels are coming off of the cart.
Time now for our news review segment, where we take a look at one of our stories in a little bit more detail. The EU Commission chief says there is no rigid timeline for Kiev's accession to the European Union.
There are no rigid timelines, but there are goals that you have to reach. Reforms, for example, to improve a situation in the candidate country to then reach the accession negotiations and the accession itself.
Ursula von der Leyen praised Kiev's determination to meet EU recommendations despite being at war with Russia. Elsewhere in her remarks, the EU Commission chief said a new package of sanctions against Moscow is on its way to make Russia pay for its actions in Ukraine. She said technology will be targeted in the fresh sanctions to curb Russia's ability to produce drones. Meanwhile, the Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky urged the EU to accelerate its arms supply to Kiev.
If weapons are accelerated, namely long-range weapons, we will not only not withdraw from Bakhmut, we will begin to deoccupy Donbas, which has been occupied since 2014.
Zelensky also said Kiev will not surrender Bakhmut and will fight as long as it can. This comes as Kiev's Western allies pledge more weapons, mainly sophisticated and long-range arms, to Ukraine. Russia has repeatedly warned the West's military support for Ukraine will only prolong the war and increase the suffering of its people. This as Russia ramps up pressure on Ukrainian forces in eastern battlegrounds and also in the northeast and the south. Joining us for more on that is Johnny Miller, our correspondent in eastern Ukraine, Donetsk, and also Greg Simmons, author and researcher from Uppsala, Sweden. Gentlemen, welcome. Johnny, so can the delivery of these weapons effectively help the Ukrainian forces advance on the battleground, on the battlefield that's been under the spotlight recently?
Well, at the moment, that seems very unlikely. Even the New York Times recently released a post, an article saying that it will take months for these tanks and new weapons to reach the front line, whereas at the moment, Russia is launching huge offensives across Donbass. They're trying to take Bakhmut, Ublodar, heavily dug in positions. The Ukrainians are putting up a very stiff resistance, but looks like the Russians at some point will take these towns. There's also an expectation that Russia may well launch a massive offensive in the coming weeks or months, and it's unlikely these weapons will be able to get there in time to stop that Russian offensive. So at the moment, this conflict can go two ways. For Russia, this is an existential war. They can mobilize huge amounts of men and military hardware, parts of their economy. They see it as an existential war. Whereas NATO and Ukraine at one point will have to at some point enter negotiations. We're already seeing some part of NATO start to question whether continuing to support and supply Ukraine is in fact a losing battle. But still, the pro-war camp led by the likes of Boris Johnson seem to be winning out. And the other way this can go is continued escalation and, of course, the very real risk of the official beginning of World War III.
So, Greg, membership of the European Union, membership of NATO, how will that exactly help the Ukrainians suffering on the ground, who are essentially calling for peace instead of war? The EU itself is suffering from an energy crisis and rising record inflation levels.
Yeah, well, I mean, you hear it's very bureaucrat speak, because we have goals but we don't have a timeline. And I mean, if we look at that in the wider context, I mean, this is similar to what they've been saying to Turkey about EU membership for how many decades. This means that there is no intention, but they're just drawing them along with this carrot. keep on fighting and dying for the US empire, because this is what they're trying to do. Keep them on the hook, so they keep on fighting and dying. This is what all of the US politicians are saying. That this is, I mean, they're all saying it between the lines, and some of them say it directly. If we keep Ukraine armed and supplied, they'll fight Russia to the last Ukrainian. I mean, this is what this is part of. These so-called carrots to join this Euro-Atlantic sphere. And, I mean, it's just not feasible. I mean, the EU, as you know, I mean, it's suffering all these kinds of crises. And Ukraine is an utterly corrupt and dysfunctional country, which would make all of the other ones look fine and functioning. I mean, look at the effects East Germany had on West Germany by integrating something that was functioning. It doesn't make sense in practical terms.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for your contribution. Let me thank our guest. Johnny Miller is our correspondent in the Eastern Donetsk region of Ukraine. Greg Simmons is an author and researcher joining us from Uppsala, Sweden. And that brings an end to another edition of the News Review.
Congratulations to everyone on the occasion of 13th of Rajab, the birth anniversary of the Commander of the Faithful and the Leader of the Pious, Prophet Muhammad's divinely appointed vicegerent, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. Here in the Islamic Republic of Iran, today is also Father's Day. We at Arabi English Radio congratulate all Muslims on this auspicious occasion.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. Enemies engineered Iran's unrest meticulously, but failed due to wrong calculations. This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with a number of elegists and religious poets in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya. On January 12, 2023. The meeting took place one day before the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamu alayha. I'd like to say just a few words about the subject of elegies today. Elegies are a part of our heritage. It is the heritage of the Shia. Yes, we do not know whether Kumayt, Da'bil, and Sayyid al-Himyari, for example, recited their elegies with melodies or not, but they would write and recite poetry and circulate the teachings of the prophet's household. You elegists have come and turned this into a complex art. Today's elegies and eulogies are a form of hybrid art. It is art. Or in other words, it is beautiful. Art is something beautiful after all. It is both beautiful and it creates beauty. You have combined several arts together, the sum of which results in an elegy or a eulogy.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
A good voice, this is the first. The next art is good poetry. That's the second. And a good melody, that's the third one. Of course, each one of these has certain characteristics, conditions, and limits, some of which I will address. In addition, you need a good theme and a good content. Because having a good poem is one thing, but it is another thing to have good content. A poem may be very good, but it may lack rich content. Or it might not have the right content. There might be a problem with the content. We have these sorts of poems, in addition to very good poems, where the poetry is good, but the content has flaws. I have written down a poem by Sa'ib Tabrizi, so that I can read it for you. He said, "Even if you tell me, you shall not see me, I'll not despair like Moses did. When Allah turned to Prophet Moses and said, 'You shall not see me,' Prophet Moses let it go. But in this poem, he says, 'I will not despair.' Even if you tell me, 'You shall not see me,' I'll not despair like Moses did. I know the sweet language of my love.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The Dutch Prime Minister recently apologized for his country's colonial past and the enslavement mandated by the Dutch state from the 17th to 19th century. Now, in his remarks, which were met with cynicism, he said that slavery must be recognized in the clearest terms as a crime against humanity. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on the so-called apology by the government of the Netherlands over the country's role in slavery and the slave trade. Many are skeptical of the apology and are demanding full reparations to the descendants of slaves. In the second part of our program today, we are discussing the historical move by Zimbabwe to ban the exports of unprocessed lithium ore in a move aimed at encouraging value addition. So stay with us as our experts give us their insight on today's subjects.
Africa needs reparations for slavery. Last December, the Dutch Prime Minister officially apologized for 250 years of the Netherlands' involvement in slavery. The apology comes almost 150 years after the end of slavery in the European countries' overseas colonies. The current wealth of the Dutch was accumulated through the evil transatlantic slave trade. This European power is believed to have shipped over 600,000 Africans as part of the slave trade, mostly to South America and the Caribbean. In Asia, at least 1 million people were traded in areas under the Dutch East India Company.
The Prime Minister of St. Martin, an autonomous state within the Kingdom of the Netherlands in the Caribbean, is skeptical of the apology. She says her state will not accept nor deny apologies for the slavery from the Dutch government.
In our many discussions since September 6th, when the first meeting was forced to hear us, it was explained that this is not the way from our side, that this is not the way to properly dialogue on a topic of such enormous proportions. Repeatedly, this sentiment has been conveyed that it is in poor taste to move full steam ahead with an apology before proper dialogue has taken place, without proper respect for the feelings of the people who you want to apologize to, the descendants of those who endured, as was mentioned here today, the most devastating crime against humanity.
Well, for more on the so-called apology by the Netherlands over its slave trade crimes, we have contacted Tunde Osazua, a member of the Africa team at the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot for joining us today, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Now, why has the Netherlands decided to apologize for engaging in the evil slave trade at this point in time?
It was a response to a report published by a government-appointed advisory board. That board had recommendations, including the government's apology and recognition that the slave trade and slavery from the 17th century until abolition were crimes against humanity. And the report said that what it called institutional racism in the Netherlands can't be separated from centuries of slavery and colonialism and the ideas that arose in that context. Also, that apology comes at a time when countries' brutal colonial histories have received critical scrutiny because of the police killing of George Floyd in the U.S. in May 2020, and the movement that was birthed in the aftermath of his death.
African academics and ancestors of slaves say Western countries that were involved in the slave trade and other colonial-era crimes should not only offer apologies, but also pay reparations to affected countries.
Yes, they should absolutely pay reparations. The loss of human life from the African continent and diaspora due to the transatlantic slave trade and colonialism had a real cost. Africa and African people weren't just deprived of lost manpower and income, but also creativity, innovation, and relationships. And, you know, those losses were multiplied by millions of lives over hundreds of years, which really stunted their development.
The Prime Minister of St. Martin says financial aid should not be conceived as reparations.
That financial aid and loans provided thus far by the Netherlands can and should never be conceived of as part of reparations owed as a result of the expected apology.
The Netherlands says it is offering only a 200 million euro fund for initiatives to help address the legacy of slavery, insisting that it will not pay reparations. Now, what's your take on this decision?
Well, I think we should look at the case of Suriname, the small South American country where Dutch plantation owners generated huge profits through the use of enslaved labor. In Suriname, the largest opposition party NDP condemned the Dutch government for failing to adequately consult descendants of enslaved people in the country. And, you know, what we understand is, you know, what's really needed is compensation, right? It's not just this apology. If you chalk up the billions of hours the enslaved Africans worked on Dutch plantations and pay that at a living wage, and you, you know, tally up the compensation of the millions of souls that were sacrificed to famine as a result of Dutch colonization.
The Netherlands usually celebrates Christmas with a controversial blackface figure accompanying Saint Nicholas, and many people consider it deeply offensive and a legacy of racism in this European country. Activists say this is a form of racial stereotyping and institutional racism prevalent in the Netherlands.
It's more than Swart Piet. It's about power, you know. Who get to decide who is Dutch or not? Who get to decide whether we're going to uphold a racist tradition or not? And who get to decide what is racism or not? So we are talking about identity also. We are talking about whatever slavery has manifested into our souls as today, how we behave towards one another.
The apology by the Netherlands Prime Minister came after a report found that people within the Dutch Foreign Ministry had been exposed to racist comments, and some were even passed over for promotion due to their skin color or ethnic origin. With such reports, is the apology in itself seen as an act of hypocrisy?
Absolutely. The apology is definitely an act of hypocrisy when these states, like the Netherlands, refuse to make any material impact or change as, acknowledging that they've done wrong along with that. As Frantz Fanon once wrote, right, the wealth of imperialist countries or nations is our wealth. You know, Europe is literally the creation of the third world. So, you know, if we understand that colonialism built Europe's wealth, then total repayment would mean giving it up and changing these conditions that allow for, you know, racist comments, you know, the passing over for promotion and other, impacts or effects of racist ideologies. And so, I mean, as I think as long as, there is a gap in wealth between, you know, the colonizing European countries and the colonized countries in the global South, in Africa, Asia, and the Americas, you know, these apologies, like what the Netherlands did recently, will be acts of hypocrisy.
Some African academics say that no material compensation can ever be enough for crimes of slavery, apartheid, or genocide. So it's better to accept apologies and move on.
You know, slave traders had no trouble pricing a human life, and abolition-era economists repaid slave owners for the losses of their freed slaves. It seems that it's only when the descendants of those slaves, those negatively impacted by colonialism, only when they return to ask for compensation does counting become difficult. When they're trying to receive some sort of, compensation for their lost ancestors, that's only when things become difficult. But I don't think that that's where we should stop. We should press on and push until we win those full, honest, and courageous reparations that we deserve as colonized people.
Last year, a four-day summit on the theme Advancing Justice, Reparations, and Racial Healing was held in Accra, Ghana. Speaking during the summit, President Nana Akufo-Addo of Ghana said reparations for Africa and the African diaspora are long overdue.
We believe the calls for reparations to Africa are just. The effects of the slave trade have been devastating to the continent and to the African diaspora. You cannot quantify the effects of such tragedies, but they need to be recognized. Africa and her peoples lost out tremendously in that period, and its ripple effects are still being felt right till this very day.
The movement for reparations to countries and descendants of slavery has been gaining momentum over the recent years. Now, what needs to be done to compel European powers to start gradual reparations?
A powerful movement for reparations for centuries of slavery and colonialism, that movement needs to be built. And, you know, movement building is difficult work. It takes being in the streets with the people, developing real relationships and building unity around, these issues, as well as a joint plan of action. And so, you know, that movement building work hasn't really taken off. I think there needs to be more effort and attention placed on that movement building work. It has to connect, you know, African, the diaspora, to create like a worldwide crusade for reparations for the African and Black world as a whole. And so I think if we want, you know, these European powers to take us seriously, to, you know, actually start with reparative justice, you know, what it takes is the building of a transnational reparations movement that's strong and has some leverage.
Well, there you have it. Our analyst there says that Africans and people of African descent should unite and create a transnational reparations movement to compel European powers to pay for their crimes. I'd like to thank Tunde Osazua for his incisive analysis today. And we now take a short break before our next topic on the historic move by Zimbabwe to ban the export of raw lithium so that it can cash in on value addition. Stay with us.
Zimbabwe stops lithium plunder.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Zimbabwe has banned the export of raw lithium with immediate effect. The Southern African country has the largest lithium reserve in Africa, but European and North American companies and smugglers have been extracting the valuable ore without paying their dues.
The growing global demand for electric vehicles and renewable energy has seen Chinese companies investing in lithium mining in recent years. A Chinese firm has purchased a lithium mine near Harare, a move that authorities in Zimbabwe believe will halt the plundering of this country's lithium by Western multinationals.
Speaking during the commissioning of the lithium processing plant in Bikita, Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa said that such value addition projects will have win-win benefits for all. Well, to discuss Zimbabwe's historic move to ban the exportation of unprocessed lithium, we have contacted Africa Kiiza, a development anthropologist. Now, what will be the impact of Zimbabwe's decision to ban the export of raw lithium ore?
Which is good. Zimbabwe is looking at harnessing the value from lithium to be able to empower its industrialization, to be able to empower its energy needs. And this is in line with the African mining vision aspirations. The African mining vision looks at enriching minerals within Africa contribute to structural transformation of African economies. So Zimbabwe, by doing that, is actually just implementing the aspirations of the African mining vision, and it's very good. Again, the consequence is that Zimbabwe is now showing a story, telling the reality that yes, it can work and be able to end the continued dependence of the global West, of the West and North America and Europe on Africa for raw materials.
The European Union and the U.S. have been exploiting Africa's lithium mines and leaving African countries poorer. It is expected that Western powers will resist Zimbabwe's move, like they reacted to a similar move by Indonesia, claiming it breaches international trade rules.
So yes, I foresee, of course, threats. EU is known to be a free. It has used a number of sanctions on African countries to make them accept unfair terms of trade, but also unfair policies, make them change their economic policies and even social policies. It might start threatening. That is most likely. It might start now. It might go in the EU Parliament and vote, maybe sanction Zimbabwe or something. That is most likely to happen. Even the European Development Fund, the EDF.
Western companies have been exploiting Africa's lithium mines and leaving the countries poorer, only to come back and sell them processed minerals in the form of smartphones, car batteries, and other rechargeable electronics.
In a bid to stop this exploitation, Zimbabwe has partnered with China and is now one of China's closest partners on the African continent. Now, this has led to anti-China rhetoric in Western media outlets. The Zimbabwean vice president has responded to this Western propaganda.
We get some uninvited voices talking about the friendship between the People's Republic of China and Zimbabwe, trying to blacken what has been achieved through the help from the People's Republic of China. So that is misinformation, disinformation, no matter how they will scream or shout, it is not going to destroy that comprehensive strategic partnership between the two people.
Others have interpreted Zimbabwe's move as beneficial to China and detrimental to Western powers that have imposed sanctions on Zimbabwe. Now, do you agree with this?
This is all about neocolonialism. This is all about imperialism. This is all about really Africa being a testing ground where all powers, all the emerging powers and the rich countries are flexing their muscles in terms of controlling Africa. It might, whether it is a threat, yes, it is a threat, of course. China is a threat to the United States.
Zimbabwe Mines Minister Winston Chitando says lithium export ban will ensure that the vision of the president to see the country becoming an upper-middle-income economy has been realized. Many Zimbabweans are hopeful that they will benefit from this historical decision. However, experts warn that the government needs to put mechanisms in place to ensure the country does not fall victim to the resource curse prevalent in Africa.
Unfortunately, there has always been a resource curse. Not only in Africa, in every country, majority of the global south, really, areas where these resources are found end up not benefiting. Actually, there is a lot of human rights violations and environmental destruction, displacement, sometimes there are civil wars, corruption, and all that. So there is a lot that the government of Zimbabwe needs to do. And to me, two or three things. One is investing the resources in social services.
Zimbabwe's ban on the exports of unprocessed lithium in 2022, followed by banning the exports of all raw mineral ores this year, is seen as a new wave of resource nationalism. The country is poised to immensely benefit from these decisions. An official at the new lithium processing plant explains.
This lithium resource will put Zimbabwe on the map as one of the premium suppliers of lithium into the world lithium battery market.
Do you think other African countries with strategic minerals such as nickel, graphite, cobalt and lithium will follow in Zimbabwe's footsteps and ban the export of unprocessed minerals? Or in other words, are we going to see a rise in resource nationalism and the end to the plunder of the continent's resources by Western multinationals?
If I was to create an utopia, I would say yes. I see African countries following Zimbabwe's stance of resource nationalism, putting an end to export of raw materials. But I don't see that is just an utopia. It's a fantasy. It can't happen. Africa remains undivided ever, more than ever actually, when it comes to speaking with one voice, when it comes to implementing decisions jointly.
Well, unfortunately, our time is up for today. Our guest there says that Africa needs to unite if the continent is to fully benefit from its vast mineral resources. I would like to apologize for the low quality voice of our guest. I'd like to thank Africa Kiza for his insight today. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Thanks a lot and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. I have a very special guest speaker for today's discussion, Shaykh Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
That's right. Okay, Shaykh Karimi, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the position and the status of Sahaba we can say this term is generally referred to the companions of Prophet Muhammad, and according to the Shiite beliefs, the companions of the infallible Imams, starting from Imam Ali alayhi salam up to Imam Asr. Now, first talk a little bit about the position of these people around Prophet Muhammad in the history. We can say what status is given to them in the words of Prophet Muhammad, the text of the Holy Quran and the Ahadith. And we can say, are the people allowed to refer to them as a holy man or not?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. One of the, controversial issues when it comes to, differences between the Shia school of thought and Sunni school of thought is the concept and the doctrine of adala, or the justice of the companions of the Prophet. Of course, technically speaking, here we are not talking about the companions of the Imams of the Ahlul Bid'ah alayhi salam. That is another story. We are talking about the companions of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, although there are many differences about the definition of the term. I will come to it. So, in our discussion, we are not talking about the companions of the Imams of the Ahlul Bid'ah alayhi salam.
Yes.
Now, the question is that whether we should believe in the justice of the companions, all the companions of the Prophet, meaning that all the people are, 100% good people, they are not doing any sin or major sins, we can follow all of them, there is no difference between them. As one narration reads in Sunni sources, the Holy Prophet is quoted as saying, according to this narration, "My companions are like the stars, and each one of them that you follow, then you are guided." Is it true or not? This is the viewpoint of Sunni scholars and our Sunni brothers and sisters. They highly regard the companions of the Prophet.
Yes.
So when we refer to the books of Hadith written by Sunni scholars, we see that there are narrations from the Prophet, also some narrations from the companions of the Prophet. So in the eyes of our Sunni brothers, the sayings of the companions are as authentic and valuable as those of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family. And next comes Tabi'un, those people who did not see the Prophet, but they saw the companions of the Prophet.
That's right.
This is the viewpoint of the Sunni school of thought. And that is why somehow this school is called the school of the Sahaba, the companions of the Prophet. Because
that's right.
After the Prophet, they refer to the Sahaba, the companions of the Prophet. They do not believe in isma, in the infallibility of these people. They call it adala or justice. Even they may claim that they may commit some mistakes. But at the end of the day, they believe that they can receive and take the religion from them. So if a companion of the Prophet says something without quoting from the Prophet, this is his own statement. He says something regarding the Islamic laws, regarding the interpretation of the Quran, and so on and so forth.
That's right.
It is authentic. It is valuable for Sunni scholars. And of course, they refer to some verses of the Quran to prove their viewpoint, and I will come to it. When it comes to Shia scholars, this school is called the school of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. So if we call Sunni school of thought this school of the Sahaba, the Shia school is the school of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam.
So Imam Ali, which is the first infallible Imam, is considered as a Sahaba.
Sure.
A Prophet Muhammad, by also the Shias believe he was among the Sahaba.
Exactly.
Okay, that's right. Okay.
Based
companion
vice
versa
of the Prophet
is impossible.
No.
Okay.
So the point is that according to the Shia scholars, we believe in the narrations of the Prophet and the other infallibles, which means we do not believe in any person to be the source of our knowledge who is not infallible.
Yes.
That is why we believe in the concept of 14 infallibles, that is the Prophet, Lady Zahra Salamullah alayha, and 12 Imams. Any narration coming from them is only authentic. Okay, Salman is great, Abu Dhar is great, or the companions of Imam Baqir, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. But, and in their narrations may find many, many beneficial points. But as long as they are not quoting from the Prophet, they are not quoting from Imam Ali or Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, and so on and so forth,
yes,
their narrations cannot be the source of our religion.
Okay.
It doesn't mean that they do not have any value, but it makes much difference whether it can be the source of your religion or not. So that is why in the books of hadith written by Shia scholars, if a narrator of hadith, for example, Durara, says something without quoting from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, this means that this is his viewpoint, which may be correct, it may have some good points in it, but we cannot refer to it as the source of, for example, the Islamic laws. This is the main difference.
That's right.
But now, which one is true? I mean, should we believe in the companions of the Prophet as Sunnis believe, or as the Shia scholars believe?
Yes.
Now, the whole concept of companionship of the Prophet is more important for Sunni scholars, because for them it is very important to decide which one should be called a companion of the Prophet or Sahabi. But it's not that important for the Shia. That is why among the Sunni scholars there are many discussions about who a Sahabi is, who should we call a companion of the Prophet. So, as I mentioned, unfortunately, there are different definitions for the concept of Sahabi or companion of the Prophet. So, some people believe that a person who is with the Prophet for 1 month is called companion.
Yes.
Some believe that, no, 1 day is enough. Some people believe that, no, even 1 hour is enough. And about the conditions of that person, should it be, for example, after bulugh maturity, or if he sees the Prophet before his maturity is enough? For example, Muhammad ibn Abi Bakr, when the Holy Prophet passed away, he was only 3 months. Should he be considered as the companions of the Prophet or not? Okay. There are differences among the Sunni scholars.
Yes.
As I mentioned, for the Shia scholars, it's not important at all whether you're considered the companion of the Prophet. In and of itself, is not that important, although it may be a great virtue for you if you accompany the Prophet and take the most out of this opportunity. So first of all, there are differences of ideas about the definition for the term Sahabi. And according to some, the best definition is that the person who sees the Prophet while the Prophet is alive, and while the Holy Prophet is alive, he converts to the religion of Islam.
That's right.
So this is one point. This is one problem, it's better to say, because we do not find any final definition for the term Sahaba from Sunni sources.
That's right.
Now, the second point is that the Shia scholars do not negate the fact that the great companions of the Prophet helped him a lot, helped the religion of Islam a lot, those people who were present in different wars, in the battles of Badr, Uhud, Khaybar, Khandaq, and so on and so forth. Those people who converted to the religion of Islam in Mecca, in all those years of difficulty, going through so many persecutions and tortures by the pagans. So they did a lot. They served the religion of Islam. But does it mean that there is a guarantee for them so that they are free to do any action later in their life? No. It's very, illogical to claim that the Holy Prophet has said that all the people who converted to the religion of Islam and helped me, then all of them are just people, all of them are mujtahid. Because this is also mentioned by Sunni scholars that all the companions of the Prophet are mujtahid, meaning that they can act upon their personal viewpoints. So it is against the logic of the Prophet.
Yes.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir. Insha'Allah, insha'Allah,
insha'Allah, you'll find your way. For example, those people who did not sacrifice anything for Prophet Muhammad on his way, you know, they did not dare to come to the battles, they did not dare to sacrifice their lives for that.
Now, the point is that According to that definition of the Sunni scholars, we have tens of thousands companions of the Prophet. So can we claim that all these great number of the people, I mean the companions of the Prophet, are just people? It is against the logic of